Good evening. Welcome. So this month we're focusing on wise concentration. But before we go into concentration, let's just talk a little bit about attention in general and how we usually use it in our normal worlds. Because so much of our lives, we are a little distracted. We're a little bit split in our attention. We're thinking about tomorrow's meeting and tonight's dinner. You know, we're trying to figure out, track what our kids are doing and what we have to do for our careers. There's all these pieces we're constantly juggling. So our mind gets really distracted. You know, I don't watch very much television, but when I do, like especially when I around these times of year visiting my in-laws, it's just amazing watching how quickly the image changes on the commercials. I was timing it. It was like, you know, like a second, 2 seconds was about the max. Maybe a particular image might last 3 seconds, but it's like that quick of a change around. And not being used to it, it was a little bit jarring to try to keep up with that. But that's part of our attention span. Now, often our attention is driven by our desire, what we want. You know, that's what we really focus on. We bring our attention to bear upon that, sometimes in a very obsessive way, a very driven way. I remember times in the past when I've been obsessed with a particular thing, I might just, there's a way that the whole mind clouds around that particular object, that thing that I want, that I need. And it's one enticing thing after another. You know, and people who market kind of figure out how to put those little carrots in front of you so you keep chasing that, how to engage your attention. Of course, there's also the attention that comes from fear, from anxiety, from worry, and that can also have a very gripping quality. We just can't stop thinking about this issue at work, with our family, with our own health, with our own bodies. It just is so caught in that, almost this gravity of that obsession. Hard to not focus on in that. And this is the quality of attention that often is untrained, that just goes to where it wants or where we don't want. And we're very much at a victim of that tight quality of attention. If we look closer at that, we see that it's really driven by our thoughts. It's driven by our concepts, our ideas of what we want, what we don't want, even the sense of who I take myself to be. You know, the lack of me, what I want to become, what I don't want to be anymore. You know, all these form this way we focus our attention. Narasagada, an Indian saint, spoke of fear as a memory of pain. You know, the fear that we project in the future is this memory of the pain that we've had. It's really driven by our thoughts. And pleasure or desire is a memory of pleasure. And how we remember something pleasant, we project that into something else. So you can see thought is a big component of this. And the hallmark of all this kind of normal attention is that it's not so settled. It's not so calm. You know, we feel a little agitated. We feel gripped, driven by this need to attain, to focus and get, or to get away from. To get rid of. Of course, there's other ways that we develop our attention through our training in our professions, maybe through an artistic endeavor, martial arts, and we start to be able to have that quality of being present and focused in a way that's trained. There's another element too, that when we kind of get shocked out of our normal way of being in the world, our normal way of assumptions of how the world works. Oftentimes when life hands us grief, hands us loss, or hands us beautiful joy and opening, and we just kind of fallen into a quality of being present, being attentive without effort. This is a natural quality of concentration of this unified mind. So this is like the normal way we think of attention and how it operates. Now in Dharma practice, we cultivate this other quality of almost intentional attention, concentration or steadiness of attention. So concentration is a word often translated from the Pali meaning samadhi. It's this unification of our mind, unification of our attention, a sense of being collected and unified, not divided, not distracted, that our attention is settled on this particular object or experience. Sometimes it can take a very narrow, like a pinpoint focus. Sometimes it can be much more broad, almost just a stance that we go through life with a quality of being attentive to whatever is arising in front of us. And so looking at this, what's the relationship between mindfulness and concentration? You know, the previous path factor is that of mindfulness. Is concentration mindfulness on steroids? Is it just kind of really a beefed up form of mindfulness? And yes and no, there's elements of it that are similar, that there's this steadiness of attention, which is inherent in mindfulness. This ability to steady our attention on what's arising. In mindfulness, we tend to focus on the changing phenomenon of experience, the changing landscape of it, and also starting to see our relationship to it, how we're taking form or identity in relationship to that. And as mindfulness matures and deepens, we start to settle into a quality that's beyond our identification, beyond the sense of me observing. So it's just the observation in itself, the deep knowing in itself. Now concentration has an element of focusing on a particular element, especially in the development of concentration, with exclusion of everything else. You know, as we worked on in the guided meditation, is to focusing on something like the breath, and you release everything else. A thought arises and it's released. Another sensation arises, it releases. And you just keep coming back again and again. Right? This is often how we start training in meditation, because this quality of steadiness of attention is so underdeveloped and we have such a distracted mind. So we have to learn to train our minds to have that steadiness of attention. So it's a key element. If you've ever been on a retreat, you may notice that there's a point where you start to look out in the environment, in nature, having food, whatever it might be, and there's a sense of heightened awareness, heightened sensitivity to life, that things are much more rich and vibrant. And this is the effect of a concentrated mind. As the mind becomes more concentrated, our senses start to wake up. And this is the other big benefit of concentration, is that sensitivity we can start to use to look at investigation, look at mindfulness, so it has a deep steadiness of and clear seeing, a way of penetrating through the fog of our conditioning. And we start to see more and more subtly, the subtle movements. See, ideally our practice starts to move from these kind of big, gross expressions of greed and hatred and reactivity to more than just this subtle quality of, okay, I'm starting to get just a little bit reactive. If I can catch it then, it gets much easier to manage, much easier to open to try to release. Like the old adage, a stitch in time saves nine. A reactivity caught in time saves a divorce or something. Or you can find some nice saying for that. Now concentration is a broad term, samadhi is a broad term, has a wide ranges of levels and depths of concentration. So I just want to speak of that a little bit. Sometimes the deeper levels are called jhana states or absorption states, trance states. These are states when everything else really falls away. There's a way that we start by just coming back again and again. If we do that with enough cultivation, enough practice, and often this does take a retreat environment over many days, then our minds just absorb into the object of attention. So everything else falls away for a period of time, right? The absorption state. Now if you read the suttas, These are often peppered throughout the suttas, these concentration states. There's actually 8 of them. Okay, so we're not going to go into those, but each of them have a more refined level of steadiness of attention, of concentration, of absorption. And there's different ways that they're taught, and there are different jhanas. One school's jhana may be a little different than another school's jhana. So not to think that there's only one quality of absorption that is possible. Now it's interesting to reflect on why that's so prevalent in the suttas. And if you look at the Buddha's early life before he became awakened, before he became the Buddha, he actually, you know, he renounced his life, his riches, renounced his family, and went into this wandering monk mode. He really was seeking some way to find an end to suffering, to an end to the distress of old age, sickness, and death, to see what is there beyond that. Is there some possibility? And so he went to some of the most renowned masters of his time. And he studied under 2 of them in particular and got to the point of such mastery that they said, you know, we want you to start to teach alongside of me. And these are both absorption practices, concentration traditions, traditions focused on these jhanas. But the Buddha declined. Because he knew that these states, these practices, even though how deep they might be, how beneficial they might be, they weren't the final resting place. They weren't the final place he was seeking. Because he felt he still, even though there was this transformation from them, he didn't feel like he was liberated. He hadn't achieved what he had started to achieve. And this is an honest thing that we have to reflect on if we are drawn to jhana practice. That the jhana practices, if you practice it, and even if you don't practice the jhanas, just concentration states, often there's where all the bells and whistles are. That's when you have these states of this immensity of being, this sense of brightness, of expansion. They can feel like, wow, this is really spiritual. This feels really special. It just feels like, okay, I'm right. I'm enlightened or just about to become enlightened. It can be very magical and very alluring. Right? But if you look closely, those states are just states. They arise and they pass away. We can cultivate conditions so they arise and they, you know, have the effects, but then they eventually pass away. And so the Buddha saw that he was looking for something that doesn't pass away. A liberation, a freedom that's not dependent upon the conditions. And this is a trap that we can fall into as meditators, that we can find these places of feeling deep peace that seems so tranquil. We say, okay, that's it. And I have to just get back to that. Have you ever had your mind thinking that? You know, okay, that state, that was it. I have to get back to that. Sometimes it's very obvious. Sometimes it's a subtle leaning. Right? But that subtle leaning is really separates us from, makes freedom further away. Whenever we want our experience to be other than it is, that dissonance is embedded in the foundations of suffering. It's embedded in the second noble truth, the origin of suffering. So the Buddha saw this and he kept searching. He kept working and went to different traditions, different practices until he had his final full awakening. Now the Buddha was also very clear about the jhanas. He actually, many times in the sutta, he says the jhana is dukkha. Literally that, jhana is dukkha. This state is dukkha. This sublime state, this highest level is also dukkha, is also suffering. It's also impermanent. It's not substantial. And that's a very deep honesty in our practice. So in the larger meditation scene, there's kind of a 2 camps. There's a camps that say you have to practice jhana, and there's a camps that say you don't have to practice jhana. Right? So sometimes it's confusing if you see other teachers and how they convey that. My teacher, Rodney, was never a proponent of teaching jhana states. So that's not part of my training or my inclination. Because he felt that jhana states had too much of that allure that people can become lost in. Right? Other people say that jhana states can have a very deep purifying effect on the mind and are very helpful. So just saying that, the level of concentration we need isn't to that trance level. We need enough steadiness of attention so we can see clearly. And in that clear seeing, then we move into insight. Now, why do we need concentration? You know, concentration, it's part of the whole purpose of this practice from a dharmic standpoint is to wake up, right? To be liberated. And that implies that we're asleep. What are we waking up from? And there's this cloud of ignorance, of delusion, of greed and hatred that we tend to move through life with. We tend to be lost in thought, lost in reactivity, lost in self-identification. Right? These are such deep patterns that as we start to look and practice, those patterns load up right from the beginning. Like turning on your computer, operating system loads on, and everything is based on that operating system. So we have these operating systems of identification, of selfing, that load up right from the beginning. So we need concentration to be able to start to go through and see clearly that those are loading up, that those aren't the essential part of who you are, of what you are. The hindrances sometimes are spoken of as these expressions of these roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. Like sleepiness, when that arises, it can be this expression of delusion, of not seeing, of covering up. And so having a strength of concentration allows us to start to penetrate through that fog, to see through that. Because when things are painful and difficult, our attention kind of jumps off it. Have you noticed that? It's not so easy just to, let me just feel that intense emotional heartache. You know, our DNA tends to move away from pain. Right? So concentration gives us the steadiness to see that without flinching, without becoming reactive. So in this way, concentration's a little bit like exercise, that we have to get a certain cardiovascular, you know, threshold, get enough conditioning that we can exercise, that we can develop a capacity. And so concentration practices start to develop that capacity to be able to see, especially in times when it's not so easy to see, in times where we most need to see what is present. So we start to develop this base level of concentration that we can fall back on, that we can draw upon when needed. And this concentration then starts to help the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path come alive. That's why it's embedded in the Eightfold Path, the concentration aspect. So concentration, in terms of the Eightfold Path, it has this wise part, the right concentration, wise concentration. Right, so let's look at that for a little bit here. You know, so often the sense of suffering or the Four Noble Truths can feel like a kind of a philosophy, a concept that I'm trying to understand. And trying to actually see it in our direct experience can be a little elusive. You know, what's the origination of suffering? What is dukkha in this moment? It's actually much simpler than that. Just the next time that the moment isn't completely sufficient how it is, that you have nothing, no need to move anywhere other than where you are, that's the time that there's dukkha arising. When there is a sense of suffering, of unease, of anger, of fear, of insufficiency, those are all elements of the Four Noble Truths being present. There's dukkha that's there. There's origination of dukkha and how you're taking form around that. So concentration allows us to actually see that. We just simply meet that experience, like going right into that experience, feeling it as a body experience, noticing the quality of mental construction, of assumption, of identification that forms around that. Now to do this, we have to, when I say to see through, we have to shift out of our normal way of seeing. Because normally we see kind of from a place of evaluation, of comparison. It's like, okay, I sit back and say, okay, that fits into this experience. I can put it into this cubbyhole of my life, of my memories. Right? That's how we naturally see. That's how we kind of interpret life. This triggers something good, something bad in me. And in, that's part of that operating system. We're really coming from this assumption of separation, this assumption of self-identity as how we're seeing through. And so concentration allows us to be much more still and quiet and starting to see before that loads up, to start to see, oh, how am I seeing life without my preconceptions, without my prejudice, without my assumption of how things should be. And we drop those assumptions, we actually start to see directly, life more directly. I mean, this is an obvious statement if we see in our life. When we're going through life and we meet someone, we may have a load of prejudice that rises up. Oh, that person triggers this in me. But if we get willing to see through that, to connect with who that person actually is, it's a very different experience. And we feel that on the other side, when people have a prejudice toward us, that they don't see us who we are, they see through their projection on us. Right? So this happens in these gross, big levels. These happen at very subtle levels in terms of how we take ourselves to be. And so this wise concentration allows us to see the Four Noble Truths as an actual alive arising this moment, a live experience of how am I relating to this moment? How am I creating suffering identification? And where is the release of that? Where is the end of that? The Third Noble Truth. Now the Eightfold Path, it's a relationship to concentration and how those work together. So Eightfold Path, you can think of it really as these three sections as I've spoken about. The first section is that of the wisdom section, the Panya. And that is the wise view and wise intention. And a wise view is the understanding of the nature of suffering, the origination of suffering, the cessation of suffering. So this wisdom aspect. Then there's the action aspect, or the sila, how we actually engage through our words, through our bodies, through our livelihood. And then there's the cultivation section, and that's where this concentration is. Mindfulness and concentration. It's like we're cultivating this quality of seeing, kind of cleaning up the lens of attention so you can see without our judgment, without our preconceptions, and developing this steadiness through concentration. Now we can see it as a circular process of deepening. That cultivation, this mindfulness and concentration, through practicing it, starts to develop wisdom. Wisdom comes from this direct seeing. The wisdom then starts to inform our actions, inform how we are in the world. As our actions start to clean up, then we have a deeper level of steadiness and stillness of mind, which allows deeper mindfulness, deeper concentration. And so you can see the cycle, any place in it, they all reinforce each other. In the Great 40 and the Middle Length Discourses, it begins with this way, that the Buddha said, now what is a noble right concentration with its supports and requisite conditions? So here's the definition. Any singleness of mind equipped with these seven factors: right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness is called right noble concentration with its supports and requisite conditions. So in this sutta, he's really talking about how concentration needs all these other elements. You know, otherwise it can just be this obsession. It can just be this sense of the cat at the mouse hole. It's completely focused, but it doesn't have all these other elements. So finally, I'd like to just talk a bit about how to cultivate concentration. Now, as a teacher, I've noticed that some minds have a natural inclination toward concentration. There's just a natural way that they fall into that steadiness of attention. While other minds are more lively or more geared toward investigation. Right? And so it's important to kind of notice that. And as a teacher, I try to strike this balance between supporting what is already strong and developed and helping that develop further. And the other side of it is balancing what's not developed. And so cultivation of steadiness of attention, of concentration, is something that for some of us is very easy to do. We fall into that. Other ones, it's not so easy. Right? But it's important to balance that, to develop this capacity to have this steadiness of attention. Now, if you are in the camp that find it really easy to steady your attention, you may find it's easy and it's also really enticing because it creates these pleasurable states of mind. So just remembering what I talked about, that too is dukkha. That too is not to be confused with liberation. It's just a state that arises. Now, the first cultivation or way to cultivate concentration is through our actions. It's actually through our wise speech, through our wise actions, and our wise livelihood. Because if we're going through life, think about the last time that you wanted to tell a little lie or a big lie. And you felt the impulse to do that, and you decided to tell the truth instead. Okay, it might have been difficult to do that. But you may have noticed as you did that, there's a sense of settling. It's like, okay, I'm aligned with what's true. Well, if I go into the lie, there's more agitation, more of a sense of unease. Right? So the mind that's filled with worrying about telling truth and telling lies becomes less settled, becomes more frenetic, right? When you align with truth, there's a sense of being settled with that. Same thing with harm, with actions of harm. You know, as we lash out, as we steal, as we hurt, all those actions create a certain turbulence in our system. As we start to align more and more with non-harm, that naturally cultivates an inner stillness, an inner quiet, which is a beautiful support for concentration to develop. Same thing with livelihood. You know, as we go through life with a one that we can feel like we can relax into that we're not causing harm, that we're aligned with our hearts in our work. There's a sense of being able to relax with that. Now often we do come into practice with a level of stress, with a level of worry, of anxiety. Life is so full of things to worry about, so many things to do. Busyness. So our system, our physiological system is literally a little amped up. It's hard to develop concentration when we're really amped up. You know, I've tried that. You know, I've tried the kind of roll up your sleeves and just bear down and focus. And it has a certain benefit, but it also has a certain cost. Because you start to get tighter and tighter in that kind of a practice. So another important condition for concentration is a relaxed, happy mind. You know, so our sense of non-harm develops that happiness, but also the sense of being intentional about what we focus on. That's what the homework tries to point to and what we did in the guided meditation, was to start, instead of jumping into focusing just on the breath, like it's a wild rabbit you're trying to catch. It's like instead, just letting the body relax And then noticing what in the moment is actually pleasant, is actually comfortable. And calling that forth and letting your attention rest there. As you do that, you can let your mind kind of, your attention start to relax into that more and more. And in doing so, you can start to feel the system discharge, starting to calm down. Maybe be a deeper breath. The mind starts to soften, starts to unclench. Okay, from that unclenching, then you can notice, okay, does the breath start to present itself? Instead of trying to chase the breath and force yourself to be on the breath, you let the breath arise. Sometimes the breath isn't what arises. Maybe there's a sensation of the body, like the palms, or feeling that some place in the body, like doing a scan. And you just focus on that one area. Now, when we're doing concentration cultivation, we're basically focusing on one object in exclusion of everything else. Okay, so a thought arises, okay, that's not the object. Another sensation, that's not the object. Okay, just coming back again and again. Sometimes we use a mantra, sometimes we use metaphrases to develop that steadiness of attention. But taking a few moments or minutes to let the mind brighten, let the mind relax, become a little happier, can make concentration practice work much easier, much more effective and pleasant. So noticing what is good in the moment, what's right in the moment, can be a natural gateway into concentration. Because it allows the attention to start to relax. And in that relaxation, it starts to sink into, it starts to absorb. So it's like a sense of almost everything goes right into this one object of attention. It can be very helpful also to notice the kind of the felt sense of the concentrated state when the mind is steady, when it has this unwavering quality. And when that's present, notice what that feels like in the mind, in the body. That sense of everything is gathered very simply around this one object. There's this steadiness of attention. You might also notice how that state has a certain pleasant quality to it. And that can be self-reinforcing. Okay, I can relax into that. And just be careful not to become caught and trapped in that state, being attached to that state. This is where another aspect is this non-resistance to what's present in the moment. This is such an important and essential element to our whole practice. You know, the mindfulness practice, the investigative practice, is that non-resistance to what's present. Because when we think the moment should be something other than it is, we're in conflict with it. We're fighting against some aspect of what's present. You know, thinking the moment should be a certain way, you should be a certain way. You know, this moment should be more spiritual. I should be more spiritual. You know, and there's all these, this whole pile of emotions which I don't deem spiritual, like anger and rage and lust and fear, and I shouldn't feel that if I'm a good meditator. As soon as we start to have those thoughts, we've created this dissonance, this difference between what's present and what's not, what's actually here. And so this non-resistance, focusing on what's pleasant, it's much easier to be non-resistant to that, right? You can say, okay, I don't have to resist this pleasant sensation or this pleasant sound or sight. I can let my attention relax. So that the point of that is to teach you the non-resistance. And then you bring that same quality to things which are more charged or more difficult. It starts to bring it forth. Yes, often we feel that when things arise in our practice which we deem are not, shouldn't be there, you know, like the agitation, the sleepiness, the wanting, the desire, the doubt. When those arise, we think there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with the practice. An important thing to realize is that as our practice opens and works, deeper levels of those arise. You know, sometimes we have a deep opening, and after that deep opening, even deeper resistance arises, deeper contraction. It's like an invitation for it to start to work through the system. You know, teaching on retreat, often you see people come in to an interview and they might be feeling a lot of agitation. And then you see them a few days later and there's a deep peace that came after that. And sometimes they feel a lot of peace and then they're going to feel the agitation, you know, in the next few days. And so it's like there's these kind of wells of I don't know if you've ever swam in a mountain lake. And sometimes there's these kind of wells of warmth and coldness. It's like, what, you know, I just moved 2 feet and it's really cold here. It's like these kind of wells of tranquility, of steadiness, and also these wells of hindrance, right? And so it's like starts to move through our system. And when those arise and we have this fighting with it, this resistance, they set it up stronger. But if we just say, oh, this is what the moment is holding, that allows us to relax into this. And so concentration, if we developed enough of it, we can start to call that forth. Okay, let me be steady in the midst of feeling very unsteady. Let me be steady in the midst of this emotion, of this sensation. Right? And meeting that with that steadiness, with this non-violence, with this non-judgment, allows that to release at its own pace, its own timing. So concentration is such an essential aspect of our practice. We don't want to emphasize it too much, but we also don't want to under-emphasize it. It can be cultivated through just simply focusing on one object, but also concentration naturally arises as our passion, as our burning interest arises. You know, things that we're very vitally interested in, we're naturally attentive to. It doesn't take work to be steady with our attention. It's naturally there. You know, so to also realize that concentration becomes more and more of a natural state, that the mind becomes more and more concentrated. We're naturally more attentive. You know, those of you who've talked about, and especially early on in the beginning series, kind of the contrast of how you were at the beginning of the class and near the end, that people start to relate to you differently. And a lot of that is because you're more attentive. You're more present. This is the quality of concentration, of samadhi developing in you. You can actually hold your attention, you can actually listen without reactivity, without flinching, with an open heart even. The sense of receptivity, of feeling this other person's experience. This is part of the fruition of practice, that we don't have to practice very long to start to see that. That's the power of cultivation, that's the power of concentration arising and developing in us. All right, thank you for your kind attention. And let's just sit quietly for a moment or two before we open to some questions. So as we open to any comments, observations, questions, just the homework for this week is basically to practice concentration. You know, for at least part of your meditative period or maybe the whole period, just to cultivate that quality of steadiness of attention. And I gave some instructions about basically how I sit in the talk in the guided meditation, that sense of being a brightened mind, a calm, happy mind first, noticing what's pleasant, and then letting the breath arise and letting the attention steady on that. So practice that this week, and then next week we'll do a discussion about that and see what effects that has had both in your practice and in your life. So are there any questions that we can dialogue about? Yes, Eric.
I guess this talk is actually maybe think a little differently about what the meaning of concentration is, because for me I always think concentration is like being goal-oriented.
Yes.
Focusing on a specific outcome. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm getting from this is concentration, I guess right concentration for rather than an outcome or an attachment to a certain ending. It's more of getting less attached and more approaching it for an intention.
Mm. Yes, yeah, basically. So to repeat it for the recording, that realizing that concentration is different than our kind of our normal way of thinking of it. Sometimes we think of concentration as this goal-oriented focusing toward a particular outcome. And this sounds like it's much more of an open-ended, the right concentration. I would say kind of the way that, you know, semantics and words, you know, we can define words however we want. I would say that the sense of being focused on something, really driven, is like that sense of alignment, of focusing, of commitment, you know, is one quality. While it's true that concentration doesn't have that same element to that same way. Concentration is much more of this, ultimately it's this capacity just to have a steadiness of attention, just to be non-wavering in our attention. You know, just to be right here, you know, not to think about this or that, to have the whole mind unify around this. So it's not to any outcome, to any goal or purpose. It's simply being present. Is this much, you know, kind of level of concentration that in our practice finds very helpful. Now, that being said, sometimes the cultivation of concentration, sometimes the goal orientation can slip into that. I've got to focus just on my breath in order to get to this level of concentration, of jhana. And sometimes that can slip in there. Sometimes there's an intentionality of letting the mind incline toward these different jhanic states. But ultimately, it's really that level of just steadiness of attention which is the most useful. Because that steadiness of attention allows insights to start to arise. We can sustain our attention long enough to see through our delusion, our reactivity, our identification, to actually see the nature of how something is. In that seeing, an insight arises. And sometimes those are so deep, they transform our lives. You're welcome. Yes.
How can our devices interfere with device concentration?
So how can our devices interfere with our concentrations or with our wise concentration? Well, let's just talk about concentration first, and then we'll add the wise part second. So the devices, I mean, if you can think about concentration as often we're used to focusing on something that we find interesting, that we find alluring, you know, something we're curious about. So the devices are really feeding into that. They're designed, they kind of figure out how to make the mind pay attention. Say, I want to follow this link, I want to follow this, you know, see what my Instagram's doing, all those kind of things. We get really engaged in that. It's really hooking into that desire to be stimulated, to be entertained, to be curious. Now, concentration itself, though, doesn't have an agenda, like the last question. You know, so often we pay attention for a reason. If I pay attention to you, you'll give me something. You know, if I pay attention to this show or to this thing, I'll get some entertainment, I'll get some information. While concentration is much more of simply paying attention for its own sake. Especially with things which are more, we might say, boring, or not so jazzy, or so enticing, like the breath, like a sensation. It's like, okay, that's not like, it's not like a YouTube video. You know, it's just, you know, it just has this simple quality. And so part of our devices is it's kind of going away from that simplicity of the moment's experience. You know, we're going into the abstraction versus the concrete nature of this body's experience, or the concrete nature of this interaction with another person. You know, as I talk to you, you know, there's a sense of tracking the body and feeling the exchange of energy, of, you know, there's all these communications that's happening in this simple arriving here. It's hard to get that same quality with the device. It's kind of, it's more one way. You're having your reaction, and it's kind of, you know, it's sensing it by what buttons or which things you do. I have a flip phone, so I'm a little... But my daughter has a smartphone, so I've observed this. So does my wife. But anyway, and so that's a big aspect of how it untrains us to be concentrated, to be steady. And notice, like, the next time that you don't have anything to do, I mean, what's the first thing that we, most of us do? Is we, you know, we're pulling out our phone. You know, I was, you know, I'm old enough to have lived before cell phones. And, you know, you were hanging out with a group of friends, you would have to talk and actually look in the eye and, you know, maybe write a letter or, you know, have a difficult conversation. And it's, I find it sad to watch a group of younger folks sitting, you know, standing around and they're on their devices. And it's like, wow, where's that? Like, my daughter had her 15th birthday party this last weekend, and at one point there's 8 or 9 girls, and they all had their phone, and you're just sitting. You know, and it was kind of like a break from the interactions. You know, they were doing a lot of interactive stuff, but there is that way of kind of retreating into that. You can almost say it's like an unwise absorption, an unwise trance. Has anyone noticed you can go into surfing and then time kind of goes, what happened to time? Like an hour went by or something. That's one of the characteristics of absorption states from a meditative standpoint, is time kind of falls away. That you could fall into that for an hour or so, 2 hours easily. It's like we're doing that through the devices. We're getting absorbed into that. But it's not teaching us the same thing. It's reinforcing actually the deep levels of wanting, deep levels of craving, of lack, of inadequacy. It's like, you know, because we, I mean, that so much motivates us. It's a sense of lack. That sense of thing, something's not quite right. Maybe this will do fulfill that. Maybe this will fulfill that, feed that deep hunger. Right? So it really reinforces that. And that really takes us away from the wise concentration. When there's a wise or the right part, that should signal this is a path toward liberation. That's what that means. Wise means noble, means toward liberation. Period. Period. That's a key thing. When it says wise concentration, wise speech, wise view, all that is, that's, it's aligned to liberation in a very direct, clear way. In our devices, yeah, it really reinforces a different quality. Often on retreats, when I teach with Narayan in particular, she likes to do a ceremony that people turn in their cell phones, turn in their devices at the beginning, and, you know, have everyone come up, and some people, you know, hang on to them, but, you know, they offer something. And I think it's so important for us to give ourselves breaks from our devices. You know, make a rule that, okay, after 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, I put this to sleep. Maybe I have a day without device. And just see how the mind is different around that. See how the level of concentration is. In fact, that's a good homework. We'll add that to your assignment for this week, is to take a intentional fast from your device. I'll leave it up to you for how long that might be. It could be for the whole week for extra credit. It could be for an hour. It could, you know, whatever seems to be a little bit of a challenge. See what would be a challenge and go a little further than that. Thank you. Yes.
In regards to the breath, I find, because I've kind of studied the mechanics of breathing a lot in my history, that I go directly from concentration to analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Doing it right and thinking about all the things I've kind of learned about breathing intellectually. And so I find that to be a hard object.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, through prior history and training, there's a lot of detail about how the breath works. So when you know, it's not a good object for concentration because you slip into that, am I doing it right? And it becomes this barrier. So how to work with that? Is there another object of concentration? So this is also a really nice question. I mean, these are all nice questions. There's a kind of these two-pronged approaches to that. One is to go into the difficulty around it. You know, why is there a sense of labeling adding on to this experience of breath? Okay, there's a lot of learning in that. But there's also the importance of finding an anchor or a place of steadiness that doesn't have a lot of charge. And so I'm going to start with that piece because I think that's going to be the most helpful initially. And so with the breath, yes, sometimes we have our knowledge gets in our way. I think Ajahn Chah was complaining about Westerners because instead of coming with a sense of openness, like we're coming with like this library of knowledge that makes it much an obstacle to practice, like we know too much, right? And so we start to see through that knowledge. We're too sophisticated. And so learning to find a simplicity is really helpful. Now sometimes the breath too, it's like for some people it starts to trigger a quality of anxiety, of really unresolved trauma sometimes. There's that sense of not being steady with it. We want this object of attention that our mind can just settle on without a lot of static around it. So if we just settle on it, sometimes the breath works. If it doesn't work, you can pick a part of the body. Or go through like maybe I'm going to feel my hand and go up to my forearm, you know, to my shoulder, kind of just gently scan through the body. You know, go into sound, you know, listening to sound as an object. And those can be very helpful. You know, you may also start to bridge that with a little bit of a mantra, you know, breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. You know, to borrow Thich Nhat Hanh's method. And that just gives your mind something to do instead of, you know, evaluate how well you're doing. Okay, so play with those aspects. But I want you to find a steady, something to focus your attention on it doesn't have a lot of extra charge around it. Now, the other aspect, the other prong to look at is, okay, starting to see how can I relate to this moment's experience through my conditioning. Through my knowledge, my evaluation, my training, to actually see how it actually is. So this can actually be a very important koan for you, to start to learn to meet the breath in an innocent way, in a direct way. And it's one of those things, if you start to get that, it starts to unlock a lot of other things in our life. Because the same process that you're applying with your breath, we also apply to our minds, to our bodies, to who we take ourselves to be, to other people, other beings, and learning to see through our ideas and concepts around it to the actual experience is such an essential step. Right? So start to notice, the way to start to notice that is sometimes when you're focusing on the breath and you feel that evaluation come up, switch to noticing the evaluation. Because if you don't just focus on the breath, you tend to let the evaluation run in the background. You start to make the evaluation itself an object of practice, something you focus your attention on, then you can start to see through it more and more clearly. And you start to notice the felt sense of that, that sense of, okay, I'm doing this right, or, you know, of wanting to have certainty of knowledge of how things are. Yeah, and okay, what happens if I relax that? Oh, you know, I don't, you know, there's that sense of being out of control. Okay, was that so bad? You know, how much control do I really have? And you start to find a deeper peace with that. Yeah, so that's a good question. Sometimes it happens with walking practice. If you've studied anatomy, you're like, okay, you know, plantar flexion, dorsal flexion, you know, that gastrocnemius is contracting. You know, you can get caught in that whole dynamic. Right? So remember, the words are just pointing towards something much more fundamental. We're learning to see underneath the words to the direct experience. Yes.
Sometimes I wonder how narrow we take the focus. Because a concentration practice that's a little broader, and I really haven't thought about, you know, is that concentration was like a very narrow focus, but you were talking about being a little more broad.
Mm-hmm.
Noticing what comes up, but not necessarily only not doing one thing.
Yes.
And I guess my inclination is to balance the different pieces. Sometimes practice a very narrow focus, and sometimes go ahead. It's more my inclination to do a broader focus, and thus manipulating exactly what. But then I wonder if maybe I'm doing that because it's more interesting.
Yeah, so that's actually quite a big question. I mean, it covers, it points to a lot of elements. So the essential part of it, if I heard it right, is the question of how narrow to focus and how broad to focus, and what's kind of the benefit of doing one versus the other, and how do you know which one to do? You know, and if there's an inclination toward one, is that good? Or should I, you know, is that my deluding myself, I needed to go the other way, and how to decide how to work with that. So the basic answer, it depends. It depends on a lot of factors. One way to answer that, you know, again, I'm talking from a non-jhana focused concentration, more of this kind of access level concentration, you know, not the deep absorption states. Basically, we want to monitor not only what we're focusing on, but also the quality of our attention, the quality of our whole mind and body, particularly around the level of tension. Okay, so if we're trying to focus on a very narrow thing and we're having to get really tight with that, I think it's not so helpful. Right? So that sense of narrow focus, sometimes, you know, that can be helpful to cultivate that, but most of the learning is not going to be becoming a laser-focused samadhi practitioner. Most of the learning is going to be having a more broad attention. And I know you've been practicing for a long time, so that sense of broad attention, especially within my tradition, within my teacher's tradition, there's a sense of that it's much more important to see the quality of identification. Right? And you got narrow focus, that can fall away because you're just focusing so much, so clearly, that everything else falls away, including the sense of self. But it's fallen away as a kind of a side effect of that level of focus. Well, if we see in a more broad way, with the steadiness of attention, we can see the actual mechanism, the arising of self, and also see where is that self arising from, and what's the much deeper sense of presence, the deeper sense of knowing that precludes, is there before that sense of me arises. Right? And so that's the kind of steadiness of attention that is the most fruitful in my experience for liberation, you know, for practice deepening. Another teacher may give you a different thing. So that's kind of, again, geared toward your practice experience level and all those things. You know, other times, you know, to kind of flush out the, for other people perhaps, sometimes it can be really helpful to just to learn to focus just on that one aspect of the breath, to really cultivate that steadiness of attention. I remember my first retreat with Rodney, you know, remember he was doing it outside, we were doing an interview outside, and I was talking about, you know, my attention keeps wandering. And he said it's like, you know, you're trying to start like a lawnmower, you know, keep pulling and pulling, eventually it starts, and it just starts to run by itself. So we need to have enough steadiness, kind of that cultivation of steadiness, so it starts to run itself. I mean, sometimes it runs out of gas and we have to like restart it, but it can, we can have this access to be able to call that forth. And sometimes, you know, our lives, we lose that concentration. We have so much turmoil in our life, so we have to maybe steady that. So ultimately, there's an intuitive sense of what's needed, you know, to this moment's experience. What is my mind state, and what's my intention? You know, why am I practicing? Am I focusing on a pinpoint because I thought that's a good idea, because someone told me that's a good idea, or is it really something that nourishes me? You know, so ideally, you kind of set an intention for why are you practicing, but then you have to adjust, because sometimes, you know, often our intention is kind of a little mixed. We're trying to make ourselves a better meditator versus see what is beyond the meditator itself.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, good. You're welcome. All right, any other questions? Yes.
So, I used to do a practice that a very long time ago. It reminds, when I think of concentration, mm-hmm. It was that I would try to visualize a thing, an object. It would be, for most of the time for me, it would be like a candle. And that actual candle would probably be in front of me. And I'd close my eyes, and I would just try to focus, keep my visualization steady on this one thing. And if it started to stray, it was nice that I could kind of open my eyes, see the thing, and be like, oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing. So I wonder, is there something unwise, or is there a reason not to do it? It's a very natural and easy way to build concentration for me because it's something I used to do. I wonder if there's any reason not to do it.
So the question is around a particular practice of like focusing on a candle and really making your attention, closing your eyes and visualizing that image of the candle and opening your eyes when that wavers to kind of refresh that. Is there a sense of that helpful or not helpful, or any reason not to do that?
Is it concentration?
It is, yeah, it's definitely part of the concentration practice. Yeah, and so, you know, really broadly we can see there's a whole range of meditative practices which are concentration focused. So anything that focuses on a mantra, on an image, one sensation, so like metta, like TM is a concentration practice, during the candle. In the Buddhist tradition, sometimes you might focus on a particular image or sign and really focus on that to exclusion of everything else. So those states are often designed to, you focus enough that you start to, there's a shift that happens, that you start to get more absorbed in that. And there's certain, you know, benefits that come from that. So I would basically say I'm not, my own practice, I can't guide you into what those benefits are. So, you know, I'd say you can experiment with that, but also notice, you know, how it is to connect with more the natural moment of this body. That's the one side I can see, that connecting with the body gives us this kind of template of how things are changing. That starts to go into seeing how impermanence is, how the lack of identification is there in this body itself. So I don't have any strong hesitations around it. Again, it's not perfectly aligned with what we're doing, but it's not so dissonant either. Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways to practice, and finding what works for you is ultimately what's important. Thank you. Yes.
In the beginning, you were guiding us some instruction, and you said, look for something pleasant.
Right.
And when you finished, when I continued searching, and always having the breath as kind of a backup.
Yes. So the question is around, you know, can smell be an object of attention? The question is, can smell be an object of attention, something that, especially around the pleasant aspect of that? You know, it's considered one of the sense gates, so it's certainly open to attention. I think one of the problems with smell is that it's harder to control. You know, it rises, it passes, and it's not so consistent. It's a little bit like sound. That sound arises and comes, it goes away. And so what do you do when there's no smell that's present? And, you know, so I think, I think in terms of a more broad, just meeting the different experiences, smell arises, there's a sense of knowing it's pleasant, okay, and that can be a beautiful point of attention. Smell arises, you know it's unpleasant, you know, there's also that point of attention, noticing how that is. Yeah, so I think it's the main reason that's not developed is, you know, especially with chemical sensitivities, we don't want people starting to bring perfume and all those things in, and you know, our tradition doesn't do a lot of incense, so there's, you know, those kind of qualities.
But, yeah.
So the follow-up question is around the purpose of incense in other traditions. I'm not exactly sure. I think sometimes it's like in some of the Native American traditions, I know there's sacred smells or purifying smells like of sage and of different things like that that help to actually purify the space. You know, in terms of like Zen, when they do all the incense, it may be something similar. It may be something to help carry the intention out. Sometimes it's seen as an offering to the Buddha or to his spirit. Sometimes that's the way it's done. But I'm not exactly sure. Thank you.